Albany Law School President and Dean Penny Andrews is the author of the new book, From Cape Town to Kabul, Rethinking Strategies for Pursuing Women's Human Rights, which advances a new approach to pursuing human rights for women in developing democracies. In the book, Dean Andrews draws upon her experience living under apartheid and after the fall of apartheid in her native South Africa, as well as her subsequent scholarship and advocacy on behalf of women around the world, including South Africa, Australia, and the United States. Coining the term conditional interdependence from Cape Town to Kabul, Rethinking Strategies for Pursuing Women's Human Rights suggests this new approach, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dean Penny Andrews to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
What brought you to this topic? I mean, how much of this was interest and how much of it was personal circumstances?
I think it was a combination of both. So the book is a result of, you know, 2+ decades of writing and advocacy around women's rights. And I was sort of struck with the question after South Africa became a democratic state. What happens to women? South Africa drafted a fine institution with equality and rights for women and so on. And 15 years down the road, the situation of women has not improved that dramatically. And I also looked at Afghanistan and women's. There was a lot of conversation after, you know, the United States decided to go to Afghanistan, what the situation of women would be like in light of the intervention. And the question for me was, why is it so difficult to transition from authoritarianism and sexism and so on to equality for women? What are the obstacles? And that is against a backdrop of a great revolution, I think, in the law. The revolution largely has been brought about by women. And if you look at American law, for example, the impact of women's activism is everywhere. If you look at family law, criminal law, many, many areas of the law, you will see the impact of women. And I would say that in the United States, the legal equality really has come a long way. And so what I was trying to do was look at societies that are in many ways different from the United States, but also that raise the same questions. How do we transition from an authoritarian society to a genuine democracy with rights for all, including women? So I decided to look at South Africa and what South Africa had done, and then try and see how it works in other societies like Afghanistan, like Pakistan, and so on.
It seems as though when you look at that, because it's a fascinating idea of when you look at a regime and then that erodes and we become more democratic, that you would think the floodgates would open. But the problems that you see develop, especially as you point out in your book of human rights regarding women, it seems that in many cases, while exaggerated, they are basically the same problems that women face in this country and the more democratized places throughout the world.
Yes, they are. But you're talking about the floodgates.
Yeah.
So, for example, I think in South Africa, a country like South Africa, in many ways there have been great changes. And the changes, I would say, are both symbolic and substantive. The symbolic changes are the easiest ones. So in South Africa, there are many, many women in parliament. Women hold high ministerial positions. They are influential in the political sphere. But then you look at violence against women. You know, the situation in South Africa is quite dismal with respect to violence against women. In the United States, I just got back from South Africa, and it was so interesting that I was having a conversation with women in South Africa, and in the United States, the issue around look at sexual assault. In the United States, we are concerned with sort of date rapes and what's happening at colleges with women and so on.
Right.
I mean, in South Africa, women still cannot go out into the streets at night in many places. Look at what happened in India, for example, the rape case that everybody's been talking about. So I think that the symbolic and the formal structures, when the floodgates open, it's easy. But then you confront cultural obstacles. So, for example, in the situation in India, the idea that a woman is raped, it's an assault on her body. It's a physical assault. But very often the conversation, and I think that's what the conversation is about in India, and I think we talk about this way in South Africa as well. It's not an attack on a family's honor or a family's dignity. It's a physical attack. It goes to the very core of a woman's identity. So I think there has to be a cultural shift. I think as well that there has to be a cultural shift with respect to expectations of women. In the United States, I would say that there has been a cultural shift. There's not, you know, there are places where women are now where nobody raises an eyebrow. Of course, we still have to go a long way. But in many, many places, women cannot even drive on their own. Women cannot go to public places without being accompanied by a male. So what I've been trying to really do is sort of look at those differences in women's lives, but the same questions that are being raised about women's equality.
Let us look at the issue in India just for a moment of what it was about that created the international story that it became. Because there are so many horrible, egregious things that happen throughout the world that would not have landed on the front pages of the newspaper. What was it about that incident?
I think there were a few things. I think firstly, the absolute violence, the just extraordinary and brutal violence of the attack. That was something that I think just outraged people. But more importantly, this was a middle-class woman, a medical student. Mm. Poor women everywhere are assaulted, raped, burnt in Afghanistan, for example, and it doesn't get much attention. There's almost a normalcy around those. So the fact that she was a medical student, that, and I think the third was that it's just India is in many ways like South Africa. There's a way in which modernity and tradition exist side by side, and I think young Indian people, and I think Indian people just said enough. So I think it happened in an urban area, so the news could get to it. And I think that there was a combination of factors that resulted in this being an extraordinary watershed and people saying we've had enough. And I think that for India, the rape issue is about physical violence, but it's also about cultural attitudes about women.
The subtitle of the book is Rethinking Strategies for Pursuing Women's Human Rights. So when it comes to that rethinking, what is the first step?
Well, the rethinking, you know, one of the issues that I try to address in the book and that I've been concerned with for some time is trying to see what lessons we can draw from the anti-apartheid and anti-racist struggles. When you look at the civil rights movement in the United States, you look at the anti-apartheid movement and so on, there are lessons that I think we can draw from sort of some of the strategies that were adopted. So conditional interdependence sort of really tries to look at a few things. The first is that we have to take into account that women feel very, very, very strongly about their identities and their communities. So it's not just an individualized approach, that you really have to look at a woman in her society, in her family, in her church, in her mosque, and so on. The second is that I think that men have to come on board. That just as in the anti-racist struggle, sure, whites needed to be brought on board to really fight racism, I think men aggressively have to be part of that struggle. So it's not just about changing men's attitudes, but men being in the forefront of changing the reality of women's lives. The third is, I think that we think a lot about sort of individual rights and so on, but I think we really need to look at economic rights, social rights, because the economic conditions of women really determine the way that they can enjoy human rights, the way that they can enjoy equality. So, for example, to go back to the earlier point, poor women are subjected to far more indignities, violence, and so on, and have far fewer choices than middle-class or affluent women. So when you're looking at equality, you have to look at the economic situation in which women find themselves. So what I try and do with conditional interdependence is really look at a methodology that we can adopt to apply to the sort of transformation of women's lives, looking at it as a complicated, sort of nuanced approach, but I think one that may lead to a longer lasting equality.
How does that fit into leadership, not only political leadership, both male and female, but also on an activist side?
I think that it is about, I think it's an age-old struggle, and I think Dr. Martin Luther King sort of embodied this. I think Nelson Mandela embodied this. The idea that you really communicate and that you involve a large community of people so that your struggle involves, it's a struggle that is about love and engagement and not hate. And of course, anger is very good. I think the women's movement has demonstrated that. But a way of really getting people to see and educating people in a very fundamental and personal way that this particular approach, for example, an approach towards women, an attitude towards women, is just not appropriate, or that it doesn't benefit the society. If you look at societies where women are not granted full citizenship, where they're not granted full rights, they're poorer societies. They don't do well economically and they don't benefit. So the idea is to persuade everybody that we all benefit, that the society benefits if everyone, including women, are included as full citizens.
Does, given that so much of our culture is mirrored throughout the world, why can't that be? In the sense of when you see women who are powerful and women who are a great role model for other women, that cannot perhaps be mirrored in other cultures?
I think that there are some things that we can mirror for other cultures, but I think that there are also great differences. So I think each society has particular cultural attributes that are unique to that society. So I think the way that we live in the United States, we are...
And that's not to say that we have it right, by the way.
No. But when you think about what you can emulate, I think there's certain things you can emulate and then there are others that you shouldn't. So I think, for example, that in the United States, this obsession with thinness and youth and so on, I don't think that's a good thing for the rest of the world. A highly consumerist culture in the United States doesn't necessarily work well for other societies. But I think if you look at somebody like Hillary Clinton, who's
right.
smart, who's articulate, who's really committed to the, you know, to...
And she's representing this country throughout the world.
Yes, yes. So she's some, there are many models, women in the United States that I think can serve, and the UK and, you know, the affluent societies as well. So yes, there are certain things that we can bottle, and role models are important. And as I said, Hillary Clinton is one, but there are several others.
In the minute or so that we have left, where does your optimism rank?
Oh, I'm very optimistic. I always believe that we, as you know, if we look at how we've evolved as a species and how, you know, where women are today, I'm really, really optimistic. So I think that, you know, in a few decades, we are maybe not so, maybe I'm being too optimistic, but I think we can only go forward. There's no room to go back because the situation of so many women are so dire that we really can only move forward.
Well, this is fascinating stuff. You're wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you. Really great.
Thanks.
Albany Law School President and Dean Penny Andrews. The new book is From Cape Town to Kabul, Rethinking Strategies for Pursuing Women's Human Rights. And also, you know, I think you're the best smelling guest we've ever had. Smell lovely.
Well, thank you.
The new book is From Cape Town to Kabul. It's published by Ashgate. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.